No objection. That's what I would recommend. Dave?
Yeah, I wasn't clear on that. The committee report should be first. Is that? Because that leads right into the peer review discussion.
Right. That's not what I said, is it?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah, the committee report, then the SASE, and then Dr. Fogarty at the end. So we'll turn right to you, Dave.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Habitat Committee has been in a bit of a quandary over the last several months, actually. And things are becoming much clearer than they were. One of the things that led to that is the white paper that was done as a result of our last meeting. But even though we've been in a quandary, quite a few things have happened. First of all, the SASE peer review was completed by the peer review panel, which convened on February 15th to the 17th, and did a complete peer review, which was presented to you yesterday. And what wasn't presented, because it wasn't their job, is the is how the PDT will be impacted by the peer review. So when I get done here, Chad is going to do a presentation on the impact of the SASE peer review on the PDT in your binder. That is document number one. Second thing, we did have one Habitat Oversight Committee meeting on March 10th. We had to do some shifting around the staff to do that, but it was done successfully. And we were able to review and approve some EFH designations and review a few others without approval at this, to this point that require more work. The committee also discussed deep-sea coral alternatives, and we had a presentation from a NOAA representative on the NOAA coral program, and that is all under binder document 2. I won't go into that in any more detail because very little was actually decided at that meeting. The third thing I want to point out is that in the binder document number 3 relates to the Pioneer Array, and I think that's something that if you're interested in that particular issue, that you should take a close look at, because the location of the Pioneer Array south of New England has been changed in response to input from the fisheries community. And another thing that you'll see in here is document number 4, which is the council's response to BOMER. And we had, as you know, a presentation from them as well yesterday. But you should take a look at that because it's very informative. And also there is, as number item number 5, there is a response from the nature Nature Coalition. Wait a minute. Conservancy, right, Nature Conservancy. I always say TNC, the Nature Conservancy. On the same BOMER windmill proposal, and that is a very interesting letter and has some interesting graphics that go along with it. There is, in fact, no council action required at this meeting, but we will be having a presentation at the end of Chad's presentation from Mike Fogarty as the last installment on the ecosystem management plan. That was scheduled at this time because we need to pay particular attention to that, because in the staff white paper that would be presented tomorrow, in which we will have to take action on, ecosystem management, rolling everything over into the ecosystem management plan is one of the options. So I would like you to pay particularly close attention to Mike Fogarty's presentation today. It's the final installment of our ecosystem management planning. And given the direction that management is taking in general, I think it's something we need to pay particularly close attention to. And Mike would like to generate some discussion today and make sure that everybody is clear on exactly what the proposal is and what the plan is. So without going any further, unless there's any question, I would like to move this directly into Chad's presentation.
Welcome, Chad.
I have 63 slides, and I was so looking forward to being the person that stood between the council and beer. So I'm a little disappointed. But we'll see how this goes. The main thing that I want to try to do over the next 63 slides, which I'm caffeinated, so they should go quickly, is to set in context everything that the PDT has been and the committee have accomplished over the last 2.5 years with the SASE model. The peer review was informative in almost innumerable ways, but one of the major things that we, the PDT, learned is the importance of defining our terms. And so when somebody reads the peer review report, it can be unclear which specific aspects of the PDT's work are being discussed, because a lot of the stuff that we've been doing has been under the context of the SASE model, but it's not, strictly speaking, been SASE model work. So I want to try to explain to the council and the public the components of the PDT's work, how that fits into what the peer review determined as far as going forward and developing management alternatives, and also just give you all some confidence and a chance to ask questions about where we are right now so that we can continue to move forward without too much further delay. I got it here? Fantastic. Except that I can't actually use it. There we go. So I'm going to talk about the vulnerability assessment, the SASE model, the lease analysis, the cost efficiency analysis, area closure analysis, and then give everybody an indication of what's coming next. I'm going to try. Yeah. There we go. So obviously, tasked to do by the council was to identify all major threats to EFH, identify and implement mechanisms to protect, conserve, and enhance EFH of the species managed by the council, define measurable thresholds for achieving the requirements to minimize adverse impacts, and integrate and optimize measures to minimize the adverse impacts to EFH across all council-managed FMPs. This has been the guiding principle for the PDT and the committee all along. We're trying to come up with a way to quantify adverse effects and integrate and optimize across all of the FMPs a strategy for minimizing adverse effects to the extent practicable. To do that, the PDT had a couple of fundamental research questions. Which phishing activities are likely to have impacts that reduce the quality or quantity of EFH? I actually don't have it memorized, so. All right. In a manner that is more than minimal and not temporary in nature. Where within the management domain are potential adverse effects from phishing most likely to be found, and have the council's management measures minimized adverse effects from phishing over time? How well or by how much? Where are adverse effects likely to occur? How have we done in the past since, for example, 1996, when the MSA was reauthorized and the EFH provisions came in? Those are kind of fundamental questions that the council would want to know before you start talking about what types of alternatives you're going to develop for taking action going forward. So this is exactly the questions that the PDT is hoping we could answer for the committee and the council and the public. And so we went back, obviously, to a literature review, and the literature indicates that the primary effect of phishing is the physical modification of structural features, habitat features. That is, the act of going fishing doesn't have a substantial impact on the water column, on the habitat that the fish live in above the bottom. So we started with the modification of physical structure as the principle for the SASE model. Different species utilize structure differently, but the gear impacts to the structure are independent of species. So a gear is going to tow across a chunk of real estate, and it's going to have that impact. Regardless of what fish live there, we're more interested in assessing the degree of impact to the physical structure, and not the consequent effect on the species that exist there. Adverse effects from fishing are primarily a function of the gear impacting those physical features, and that's the the level of the unit that we're talking about when we talk about adverse effects minimization. We do not address the more fundamental issues that deal with the relationship between fishery productivity and fish habitat. As I said before, different species interact with habitat in different ways, with benthic habitat, with physical structure in different ways. We don't do species-specific modeling. You can go back and look at the EFH source documents. You can go back and look at the EFH maps and compare those to the areas where adverse effects are most likely, where the model is determining that adverse effects are most likely to accumulate. And you can make your own comparisons on a species-by-species basis. So if it is, for example, cod that you care about, you can look at where cod exist, what the source documents say about how cod use structure, and then go and look at where the structure is most likely to be adversely affected by fishing. But this, the unit of analysis is not on the fish themselves. It's on the interaction of the gear and the physical structure. We don't seek to define essential or which habitats are essential to which species. This has been done in Omnibus Phase 1, again, and so that third bullet is redundant. So the vulnerability assessment. Is there a time lag? Or fantastic. So we wanted to summarize the vulnerability of seabed habitats to bottom-tending fishing gears by gear type. And then this would inform the SASI model, our susceptibility and recovery indices. And the goal was to be comprehensive, quantitative, and traceable. A lot of this you all have seen before, but we did 101 studies were pertinent to our area and our gears. We had about 450 studies that the PDT reviewed and determined whether or not to include those studies in the results. We database all of these. What's important is that the majority of the studies examined trawls. There were far fewer studies for hydraulic dredges and scallop dredges. Hardly any studies that looked at the impact of fixed gears. Experimental fishing studies were found to be the most useful for susceptibility determinations, and recovery was examined only in a third of the studies. Many of those for short-term or open versus closed area type assessments. The point here is that the literature is still very thin on gear effects. We spent a lot of time, decades in fact, talking about gear effects, and yet the literature is extremely thin. So there's a lot of professional judgment that went into the vulnerability assessment by necessity. There was no other way to do it. This is both good and bad. But one of the things that the PDT, I think, should be proud of is the fact that we've been so rigorous in documenting where the gaps are, not only what is known, but what we don't know. So you can take these susceptibility and recovery matrices, and you can go back and look. We've coded each of the studies that we looked at. You can go back and take those numbers and look at the individual studies. You can read those, and you can see whether or not you agree, for example, with our conclusions. And you can also see where the literature in support of the PDT's susceptibility and recovery scores is thin. So you can look at these matrices and tell instantly where professional judgment's been used and where we have more basis in the literature. So this is part of the traceability. We have definitions for susceptibility and recovery. They're quantitative. But again, these definitions were created in an iterative process that is based primarily on what is in the literature and not necessarily on kind of ecological principles. We had to use bands that were going to comport with what we were reading in the papers and not kind of impose our own assumptions on the susceptibility and recovery scores, because the entire assessment is literature-based. So the conclusions that we're reaching are not, this is what the PDT thinks. It is, this is what the PDT thinks the literature says. And that's an important distinction because, again, a lot of times the literature is pretty thin. So the major results from the susceptibility side. So susceptibility is basically the, if you were to take a piece of gear and put it on the bottom, what percentage of the physical features would be adversely affected, would have their functional value as habitat reduced, right? So towing a mobile bottom tending, you know, an otter trawl across the bottom or a scallop dredge across the bottom, or having a gill net wash back and forth with the tides, what percentage of the physical features that are impacted by that gear have their functional value as habitat reduced? And that's what susceptibility refers to here. broadly, moderate susceptibility scores for trawls and scallop dredge gears, high susceptibility scores for hydraulic clam dredge gears, and that makes a little bit of sense because the clam dredge gears dig down into the bottom. You know, per unit of impact, they're having the most direct and kind of substantial impact on the bottom, and very low susceptibility scores for fixed gears. In most cases, the literature didn't support disaggregating susceptibility between high and low energy environments. Now, our model has, and our vulnerability assessment distinguishes between high energy and low energy environments based on the currents, the daily and the and mean maximal monthly currents that would be expected at each parcel in the domain. There's not enough literature to disaggregate effects in most cases between high and low energy, even though we know that there's huge differences in gear effects based on the kind of the natural energetics. You'd have to exceed, the gear would have to exceed the impact of the energy environment for it to have an appreciable adverse effect. But that's not something that's been studied enough for the PDT to feel comfortable with coming up with differential scores. Disaggregating susceptibility across the individual habitat features common to multiple substrates was very difficult because, again, we were doing this analysis. The grain for the vulnerability assessment is at individual habitat features. That's not always the grain that the literature was talking about. You know, they look at whatever it is that they were looking at. It can be much different things. It can be, basically the distribution of different substrates. It can be the types of critters that are found on those substrates, and we tried to amalgamate all of those things and then reapply them to our construct. The literature didn't support different susceptibility scores for scallop dredges and otter trawl gears. This is a very important point. The vulnerability assessment implies that the vulnerability of habitats to gears is basically the same for on the susceptibility side, especially for otter trawls and scallop dredges. That might be because that's actually the case. That might be because the topic hasn't been studied adequately. But that's what the literature implies. And different susceptibility scores for different types of trawl gears were not able to apply differences there for a couple of different reasons. One, we don't have the data on where different types of trawl gears are actually used, so it doesn't make a lot of sense to go through the effort if we can't code that into the model when we use actual fishing effort. But two, there hasn't been enough research on the impacts of different types of trawl gears on habitat. When you read the literature, a lot of times they'll just say an otter trawl gear. Or they might talk about what types of kit was on the ground cables or something like that. But it's not specific enough to disaggregate. For recovery times for biological features were generally independent of energy and substrate. That is, the recovery times are dependent on the critter itself and not necessarily where that critter was found. Obviously, there's a feedback loop there. Recovery times for geological features were often independent of energy and substrate. Due to different qualities of gear effect, longer recovery times are associated with scallop dredges and otter trawls versus hydraulic dredges and then fixed gears. Biological feature recovery times were kind of more homogeneous than the geological feature recovery times. So in the SASE document, which I'm not sure is in the binder, probably not because it's long and it would weight the binder down even more. But if you could get your hands on the document, for example, that went to the peer review panel, we've got – it is in there? All right. So there are little plots of the recovery times estimated for the different gears and across the different substrates. And you can look at the distribution and see that for geological substrates, in the larger substrates, the granule pebble, the cobble, and the boulder, you've got longer geological feature recovery times for somewhat obvious reasons, whereas it's fairly flat across the biological features. So this all goes to which fishing activities are likely to have impacts that reduce the quality or quantity of EFH. This was the first kind of PDT research question. And the answer is, you know, all gear types have the potential for more than minimal adverse effects. That we would say that would be susceptibility values greater than zero. All gear types have the potential for generating adverse effects that are not temporary in nature. Recovery values greater than zero. And to understand the gear-specific adverse effects spatially, all you have to do is plug these SNR values into the model, plug it all in, and that's what I'm going to talk about next. So we've got this basic model which takes area swept and modifies it by the degree of impact, the type of impact that that gear has at that place in space. So it represents the vulnerability of physical structure to the adverse effects from fishing. We do that by kind of doing the math, right? What is the area swept by all of the different gear types? And then we plug in those SNR values that we coded in the vulnerability assessment. And the basic unit, again, is this Wentworth scale of substrate. So we've got five classes, sand, silt and mud, sand, granular pebble, cobble, and boulder. All right, here's some pictures of what that might look like. This is courtesy of the SMAS video survey, of course. We gather all the geological data sets that we can find, which would be the US seabed data and the SMAS video survey, and we pile them all together, reclassify to make sure that all of the samples fit the Wentworth scale, fit our same sampling. We take a critical shear stress model, which incorporates daily and monthly tides, does not incorporate the impact of waves. Wave action is a big driver in energetics, so we have a proxy for wave action, which is a minimum depth threshold. And we combine this minimum depth threshold and the shear stress model, and we come up with kind of a two-stage high-energy, low-energy map for the domain. And so on the far right-hand panel, the dark blue would be the low-energy, and the red would be the high-energy coded grid cells. We combine the energy, the substrate, and we overlay a structured. So the energy and the substrate are based on the size of the samples themselves. Not the size of the samples, but the area around the samples. It's an unstructured grid cell. We overlay a structured grid cell and then take the distribution of the energies and the substrate types within each of this 10 by 10 square kilometer grid cells, and we come up with a percentage distribution for the energy in the substrate. And that's kind of how the data feed into the spatial substrate data feed into the map, or into the model, I should say. Some of the uncertainties, the SNR estimates reflect effects of single gear encounters. The effects of multiple tows are additive and linear, so we're assuming that recovery is independent of subsequent fishing events. So basically what we're saying is that there's two different theories, there's many, many different theories, but one theory is that the first pass of the gear has the most impact and subsequent passes are less. The flip side of that might be that there's a cumulative effect that you have to get beyond some threshold before the effects get to be truly severe. We take a middle road, which is just assuming that the effects are additive and linear. And if the first pass is more damaging, then impacts are probably overestimated in our model, and if the impacts are, if it's a cumulative effects issue, then the impacts are probably underestimated in our model. So the spatial resolution of the fishing effort, we overlay fishing effort right now based on VTR data over our 10 by 10 square kilometer grid cell, and the spatial resolution of the VTR data is clearly not sufficient for actually putting trips into a 10 by 10 square kilometer grid cell. That makes no sense. There's no individual VTR trip that probably occurred within a particular 100 square kilometer grid cell entirely, but the law of large numbers, when you have 1,200,000 VTR data, you get a pretty good representation of the spatial distribution of fishing effort. The data on the frequency of use of different gear configurations, different types of sweeps, are not available. And we don't go inside 3 nautical miles, and we miss out on any type of seasonality in the model. We only have a one-year time step. I'm going to fly through some of this. We have a neat little picture of spatial data support because we have varying degrees of data underlying the model throughout the domain. Where we have basically the SMAS video survey, we've got a survey method that's capable of detecting all five of our grain sizes, where we've got U.S. seabed data, oftentimes we are unable to detect the larger grain sizes, and it's those larger grain sizes that have the longer recovery times in the vulnerability assessment. So where we have data can drive, to some extent, the results of the model. So we produced this slide to give everybody a pretty good feeling for where we've got good data support and where we're lacking data support. And as you can see, George, within the SNS video survey, those are the areas where we have the best data support. So there's a couple of different types of model outputs. We have this Z-infinity, and anybody who was listening to Dr. Sullivan's yesterday, this is what he was talking about. Z-infinity is this kind of hypothetical vulnerability of a chunk of real estate to a particular gear type in absence of actual phishing effort. So if there were phishing effort anywhere on the within the domain, using the Z-infinity model can tell you what the impact of that phishing effort would be. It can tell you where, in absence of actual phishing effort, where the areas that are most likely to accumulate adverse effects to for a particular gear type. And that addresses the PDT research question number two. We have the Z-realized, which is the actual adverse effect based on VTR data, based on real phishing data. Hopefully that will be, over time, we'll be able to use VMS and observer data as well. And that addresses PDT research question three, which is how have the management measures minimized adverse effects? How have all of the council's management measures minimized adverse effects over time? So here are some of the results. This is the theoretical, which areas, which chunks of real estate are potentially most vulnerable to phishing. So in the left panel is going to be, I believe, otter trawl. The middle panel, I think, is scallop dredge. And the right panel is hydraulic lamb dredge. These are just kind of examples. Red would be more likely to accumulate adverse effects. Blue would be less likely to accumulate adverse effects. So, and these are the fixed gears. So the maps are somewhat interesting to look at. I mean, you can see basically that in the Gulf of Maine, kind of on the tops of the banks and morphological features, that's where you're most likely to see adverse effects accumulate. Also kind of extending along the northern portion of Georges Bank and down into the channel. And that holds for pretty much all of the gears, with the exception of the hydraulic clam dredge, which again kind of fishes in a much different way and impacts habitat in a much different way. And so, I don't think there's anything really revolutionary here. This isn't telling people anything particularly new. What's nice is that we're able to quantify it and put it on a map at a spatial scale that might be amenable for improving management, hopefully. The distribution of adverse effects by parcel, and by parcel I mean those little tiny 10 by 10, 100 square kilometer grid cells, they're strongly skewed. For all gears except for trap, between 5 and 7% of the parcels have a Z-infinity value greater than one standard deviation from the main, from the mean. For trap gear, it's actually much higher, 25%. That means there's very few grid cells that actually have a really high Z-infinity score, that are more likely to accumulate adverse effects over time. Most of the parcels within our domain are pretty similar in their potential for accumulating adverse effects. Per unit area swept, the potential for adverse effects is highest for hydraulic clam dredge. Otter trawl and scallop dredge gears are nearly identical for the reasons that I've already talked about, which goes back to the literature. And those are the next highest. And the fixed gears are much, much lower. So Z-realized, which is the actual adverse effect, is based on estimates of area swept from the VTR data, 1996 through 2009. Obviously, adverse effects were accumulating long before the initial year of data. So to start the model, I simply take the 1996 data, I run it for 10 years, and that kind of gets a starting playing field, if you will. And then we build on that for subsequent years. And then we run the model through 2009. And what we see is that if you sum up adverse effects over time, they've declined substantially between 1996 and 2009, on the order of some 60% over that time period. The majority of that decline has been in otter trawl gears, but there are other gears that have declined as well. Scallop gears have stayed relatively constant. And then this is an animated GIF that changes over time, and I think everybody's seen this before, but I love this one. It's actually kind of fun to stare at for a while. And I've actually told you all the interpretation of this, but you can see that on the left-hand side, it's the otter trawl gear. The amount of fishing effort, the amount of adverse effect, both on Georges Bank and in the Gulf of Maine, domain-wide, has declined substantially. If you look at the early years, you get a lot of green, a lot of yellow, a lot of red, and in the later years, as the time series rolls on, there simply hasn't been as much fishing. You can also, on the right-hand panel, look at the scallopjet fishery, and you can see the impact of the pulse fishing. Not only the fact that the distribution of fishing effort has moved around, but because the model has an accumulation, kind of a stock of adverse effects built into it, you can see how that stock of adverse effect declines after the rotational management area has been closed, which is something that's interesting to note as well. So since 2003, since the last major management action to minimize adverse effects from fishing, which would be Amendment 10 in the Scallop Plan, Amendment 13 in the Groundfish Plan, we've had a pretty substantial decline in adverse effect, about 31%. And again, it was about 60% since 1996, since the Magnuson Act introduced the EFH concept. So mobile gears comprise the majority of the adverse effect from fishing in our region, 99.5% in 2009. Trawl gear, 85%. Scallop dredge gears, 14%. And same thing I just said. The otter trawl gears adverse effect have declined by 37%, and the limited access scallop dredge adverse effects have declined by 15% since 2003, since the last major action. So that's how has the council done, how have council management actions done at minimizing adverse effects over time. The lease analysis has math. We'll move on quickly. It's a clustering algorithm that basically looks at not only the potential for adverse effects at each parcel, but the potential for adverse effects on the adjacent parcels, and compares that to the whole domain, and picks out areas where there are clusters of grid cells that are likely to accumulate adverse effects. And the reason we did this was because if you look at the domain-wide map of the areas where adverse effects are most likely to accumulate, you'll see lots of individual grid cells that have high potential. But they're not necessarily contiguous, and they're not necessarily going to be amenable for management that's going to integrate and optimize across all the council's FMPs. We wanted to focus the council's and the public's eyes on the areas where those adverse effects are most likely to accumulate at a larger scale than the 10 by 10 grid cell. And so we looked for these clusters. We identified seven major clusters that had groups of grid cells where adverse effects were most likely to accumulate. This will enable the council to understand the spatial structure of the SASE outputs in terms of where there are consolidated areas for potential adverse effects minimization strategies. It highlights those areas, and it points towards the right areas to focus on. It doesn't adequately define boundaries. It doesn't make any sense to take these LISA clusters, for example, and draw boxes around them, because they're driven by a couple of different things. They're driven by the underlying sampling, and then they're driven by the shape of that regular 10 by 10 mesh, where we started in the northeastern quadrant and laid the mesh across the domain. So just the boundaries of those boxes are not necessarily meaningful. You have to go back and look at what drives the highlighted results. Why did those clusters kind of pop out? Where within those clusters are you going to be likely to find the substrates, for example, that drove those results? So there are seven significant clusters. The Gulf of Maine clusters tend to occur near known geomorphic features. And a lot of them overlap pretty well with existing habitat closures. The Georges Bank clusters, they tend to occur near high-energy gravel, cobble, and boulder, particularly the high-energy gravel, cobble, and boulder, where the energy is not sufficient to move the particles, the substrates around, where the substrates are stable, which is a pretty remarkable thing on Georges, because there's obviously a tremendous amount of energy out there, and finding stable substrates is not easy. But generally speaking, where the LISA clusters are, they tend to have a strong overlap with where the stable substrates are. they have little overlap with existing habitat closures on Georges. These results should be treated as first pass, and there's a lot of data issues, like I just said, that influence cluster size. There are things that there are known sampling deficiencies. For example, we don't have a lot of large substrate sampling in the Gulf of Maine. So there might be things that we're missing. But again, the good news is that, generally speaking, when you go out and sample the Gulf of Maine, if you sample the basins, you find soft substrates. If you sample the tops of the banks, you find harder substrates. So it's not rocket science to figure out where you're going to be likely to find those substrates that are likely to accumulate adverse effects in the Gulf of Maine, even though we don't have as good data there. So the next thing that these are kind of extensions of the SASE model, how the SASE model is going to be employed in trying to make construct options for minimizing adverse effects. And this is a cost efficiency analysis. So the MSA wants us to minimize, to the extent practicable, the adverse effects on EFH from fishing. Practicability is not defined, but it does imply this kind of trade-off. I mean, we're going to spend a lot of time over the next couple of years, I imagine, talking about balancing trade-offs. So one way to think about it is that there are benefits to abating adverse effects. You know, fishing causes adverse effects. Any gear type has the potential to have a more than minimal and not temporary in nature effect on habitat. The research right now is not sufficient to quantify the relationship between those adverse effects and the knock-on effect on the fishery productivity. And so because you can't necessarily quantify, you can't say if you cause this many units of adverse effect, that's going to cost you this many dollars. Instead, you can look at the kind of a cost efficiency rather than quantifying in dollar terms the adverse effect. You can just quantify in our kind of Z unit terms the adverse effect. And so we do this by looking at how much net revenue could be generated per unit of adverse effect. And that's kind of an interesting way to think about how you would start to construct options that are going to, for example, do more good than harm. So we have this little very easy ratio of an estimate of cost, which is our Z. To construct the Z here, we simply take the value for every VTR trip, think about it, for every tow, right, you're going to have an initial impact and then you're going to have the durable impact over the years. And that durable impact decays over time. So we just sum up in year one, year two, year three, year four, what that impact is and put that in that Z net side. And then we sum up the benefit estimate, which is the net revenues that are generated by that unit of fishing. And this is going to differ. In certain areas, you're going to catch more fish and make more money, and you're going to cause a differential impact on the habitat. And that's how we construct this E ratio, to look at the differences between both spatially and between gear types in what the benefits and costs are for fishing in terms of habitat. So this might give you an example of I'm going to skip through a lot of this stuff, but kind of habitat efficiency, right? So the ZNet captures the magnitude of the adverse effect at the trip level, and the E captures the amount of benefit generated per unit of adverse effect. And this allows for an evaluation of trade-offs between measures in various areas and for different gear types. So implications of this, you know, if you go back and read the NRC report on the effects of fishing on habitat, you know, they basically say that you've got three major tools to work with, and you all have heard this all before. There's area closures, gear modifications, and effort reductions. So in terms of kind of costs and benefits, how practicable are these tools for minimizing adverse effects? So closed areas, you've got differential clash rates between fishable and off-limits parcels, and that's going to cause redistribution of fishing effort. So if you take effort from a really profitable and potentially low-impact area and you displace it to a less profitable, high-impact area, you have actually had an increase in adverse effects, and vice versa. So there's costs and benefits associated with closed areas. There's costs and benefits associated with gear modifications, the direct costs of actually making the gear modification, plus there's gear selectivity and catchability issues, which are very significant. And then effort reductions. But effort reductions are almost a bit of a red herring here, because I think minimizing adverse effects, I say Z here, but minimizing adverse effects is going to be conditioned on achieving OI. Right. I mean, I haven't heard anybody try to make a credible argument for why you would need to reduce the ability of the fishery to capture OY simply to minimize adverse effects. So that is to say, the objective for the council is going to be to minimize adverse effects conditioned on achieving OY, which is a really important distinction. You can see adverse effects increasing over time if catch is increasing over time because you're getting closer to achieving OY, and that would not be a bad thing. What you want to look at is the relationship between adverse effect and the catch. Are you achieving relatively less adverse effect per unit of either dollar or pounds landed, or relatively more? That's the change that matters, not the absolute value. And I think that's a really important point. Unless somebody wants to make a case that you need to reduce catch to minimize adverse effects, which could be valid. I'm not sure. I just haven't heard anybody make that case yet. So one way to look at the cost efficiency approach is just to get a feeling for the habitat efficiency of the different gears in our analysis. So we've got this generic otter trawl, which is all otter trawls other than shrimp, squid, and raised foot rope. And you get this kind of mean E value, which is basically the amount of Z per $1,000 of net profit, net revenue that you generate. So you generate a lot less adverse effect per $1,000 of net revenue for the fixed gears than you do, two orders of magnitude less than you do for example, the shrimp trawl, an order of magnitude less and plus a little bit for the squid and raised foot rope. So this gives you a picture of kind of the habitat efficiency of the different gears in our area, and that's all this does. So if you want to think about this spatially, here I've got all of the grid cells that have fishing in them kind of mapped out by that E statistic, by the amount of adverse effect generated per $1,000 of net revenue. And you would want to focus on the areas where those E values are the highest. And the distribution looks a lot like this. Like I said, it's pretty homogeneous throughout most of the region, and then there's a couple of grid cells that really pop out. And you get the same thing when you look at the amount of money that's generated per unit of adverse effect. And so here's how it would look spatially with the cost proxy, the adverse effect in the left panel, the middle panel being the benefit proxy, the net revenue, and then the right panel being the combination of those two in that ratio. And so this is for limited access scallop dredge gear, which is a little bit more homogeneous than the otter trawl gear, and that's a function of kind of where the gear happens to fish at. But what you see basically generally, and I'll go back to the otter trawl gear, inshore Gulf of Maine generates more adverse effect per unit of net revenue than, for example, in the Mid-Atlantic. And that makes some sense, if you think about the substrates that are found in those areas and the types of fish that are found in those areas. I don't think there's anything really shocking here. So gear modifications is a tricky one. So for harvesting bottom-dwelling thin fish, gear substitution would result in orders of magnitude reductions in adverse effect. To generate a dollar of profit, otter trawls produce about 600 times more than gill nets. And this is, don't pay too much attention to the 600. It's not supposed to be a scare tactic, and I'm not trying to make any grand conclusions here, other than there are costs associated with wholesale gear substitution. If the entire fishery were prosecuted with fixed gears, the catch composition would change, bycatch would change, protected resource issues would change. So it's not as simple as saying, we can force a certain amount of the fishery to take place with fixed gears and solve our adverse effects problem. I'm not sure how the council even wants to decide whether we have an adverse effects problem or not. But certainly it's important to realize that there's, even though there are orders of magnitude differences between the ability to generate revenues and the ability to generate adverse effects between the different gear types, it's not as simple as trying to take some sort of a command and control approach towards picking winners on gear type. All of these things come at cost of catch composition, bycatch, protected resources. an interesting observation is that when we think about adverse effects from otter trawls, most of the time in the literature and in general kind of within the public, we think about the impact of the sweep on the bottom. But it's actually the majority of the gear impact is from the ground cables, which is kind of not something you hear a lot about, but that's 60% or so of the area swept. If you were to minimize the size of those ground cables, you could minimize the area swept by the gear by a lot. Of course, that comes at a cost. Those ground cables exist for a reason. So while we can quantify the reduction in area swept and the consequent reduction in adverse effect to some extent, I'm not aware of any studies. That's not true. I'm aware of two studies that attempt to quantify the relationship between the ground cable length and the catch rates. Two is a pretty small number, and there's certainly this is a good avenue for further research. So changing from a cookie or chain sweep to a raised foot rope sweep could reduce area swept by 30%. Eliminating large diameter rock hopper gear may alter fishing behavior, keeping gear off the most vulnerable habitats, but these also come at costs. Gear selectivity, decreased fishable bottom, all kinds of things. And so understanding the benefits and costs for these things is a really important aspect of this analysis. Now, I put this up as an example because what you read in the literature and certainly the underlying assumption between any sort of roller gear size limit is that it'll keep people off the hard bottom. Well, we actually obviously have a natural experiment. We have an area that has a 12-inch roller gear restriction in the inshore Gulf of Maine. This is observer data. The start and finish tow locations for all the observer data within this area, and some USGS-based hard bottom areas. The red areas are boulder reefs, right? And so, actually, I'm not remembering the numbers, but there's something on the order of 12,000 start and finish tow locations, and three of them overlap with the boulder, with the known boulder fields in this area. And we can't replicate this outside of the 12-inch roller gear area, so we can't say that you would see this result if you were fishing with some other roller gear size, because we don't have the same boulder ridge data for an area that lies outside of the 12-inch roller gear area. But if the theory is that the smaller roller gear will keep mobile otter trawls off of known hard bottom areas, this might look a little bit like it's leaning towards that, but it doesn't say anything more. I just thought it was kind of interesting. Again, if the council or the committee were to go down the road of investigating gear modifications to minimize adverse effects, I think for otter trawls, you'd have to believe that those gear modifications would do this, would keep people off of those bottoms that the vulnerability assessment says are most likely to accumulate adverse effects. So if you don't believe that, then it's not a fruitful road to go down. The last portion of the analysis is the area closure analysis. And so the question here is, if you're going to move fishermen around, if you're going to move fishing effort around, can we use the SASE model to try to assess the costs and benefits that you could see? And I said before, if you take fishing from highly profitable low-impact areas, and you move it onto less profitable high-impact areas, then you've actually increased the amount of adverse effect. That is, you can close areas and increase adverse effect. That shouldn't be shocking to anybody. Likewise, the opposite is true. You can open areas, and you can divert fishing effort from less profitable, more vulnerable chunks of real estate to more profitable and less vulnerable chunks of real estate by opening areas. That is, you can open areas and conceivably minimize adverse effects. That also shouldn't sound as shocking as it often does. So obviously fishing effort will vary with the ACE, and so all the catch is going to be consistent with OI. Area closure moves relatively constant fishing. So if you assume that fishing effort, that the OY doesn't change over a couple of years, and you implement area closures, all you're doing is moving around where that fishing effort can be. You're going to change the catch rates, you're going to change the profitability, et cetera, et cetera. And then the adverse effects abatement is going to depend on the vulnerability and the profitability of the areas closed or opened relative to the vulnerability and profitability of the areas that the fishing has been displaced from or displaced to. So we use the same ratio to look at this. So I'm only going to do an illustrative case because it's obviously a very complicated thing to model in reality, and I'm not going to try to do that for anybody right now, although we'd love to do it over the next 30 years or so. If you divide fishing grounds into kind of four blocks and you assign a different vulnerability and revenue potential for a particular gear to each of those blocks, and then you kind of close or open one block and look at what happens, this is the simple case. So here's four blocks, and each block has its own adverse effect potential and revenue potential, right? And some blocks, like block four has the lowest adverse effect and the highest revenue potential, and block two has the highest adverse effect and kind of a lower revenue potential. So under this base case, you have total adverse effects of 500, total net revenues of 275. If you close block two, you change your adverse effects from 500 to 287 or 290 or something like that, and you leave the revenues the same. So if you close an area that has relatively low profitability and high vulnerability, then you have done some good. But if you close a block that is the opposite, and here it's block four, you have actually increased your adverse effects, right? That should make sense to everybody. That should be a fairly logical conclusion. But that's the paradigm that the council, the committee, and the public need to think about when they think about how we're going to integrate and optimize adverse effects minimization strategies across all of the FMPs, which is one of the objectives for the Omnibus Amendment. So if we're going to focus on durable area closures, for example, we want to make sure that those are the right areas, that we're not displacing fishing effort from low vulnerability areas to high vulnerability areas, kind of a first do no harm sort of thing. And so I just present this as a way to think about constructing options as we go forward. So some of the conclusions from the PDT's work thus far, within the vulnerability assessment, otter trawl and dredge gears have the highest adverse effect, and this is driven by high susceptibility and longer recovery times in substrates dominated by larger sediments. From the SASE model, overall adverse effects have declined by 31% since the last major management action, and over 60% since the implementation of, magazine reauthorization introduced the EFH provisions. Per unit area, mobile bottom tending gears have the highest potential for adverse effects, and would probably be the focus for adverse effects minimization options. The LISA clusters offer the high Z parcels clustered at manageable scales so that we can try to integrate and optimize adverse effects minimization strategies across all of the FMPs. They tend to overlap better with existing habitat closures in the Gulf of Maine, and not as well with existing habitat closures on Georgia's Bank in general. And for the cost efficiency analysis, it's useful for understanding the habitat efficiency of the various gear types. It has the potential for increasing otter trawl habitat efficiency through gear modifications, but again, those gear modifications come with a cost. And for the area closure analysis, it's just important to understand that there are costs associated with displacing fishing effort. And the effectiveness of area closure strategies is going to depend on the differences between the vulnerability and the profitability at the individual parcel level. And to provide positive benefits, you have to site these durable area closures in the right spots, hopefully. So the peer review, and this is, in this presentation, I've tried to disaggregate between all of these different things, not just the SASE model, but the add-ons, the way the SASE model is going to be employed in both analyzing options and doing impacts analysis. The peer review looked at all of these things, and actually they focused a lot on the snap-on tools that would go with the SASE model, and even less on the SASE model itself. The SASE model had been reviewed three times by the SSC as well. So that was actually in pretty good shape. their conclusions on the vulnerability assessment, the SASE model, and LISA clusters, or the conclusion was that the vulnerability assessment, the SASE model, and LISA clusters were all appropriate for use in alternative development. Model sensitivity tests were performed, and the spatial distribution of Z was robust to the assumptions tested. To go forward, one of the major conclusions of the peer review was that they want to see some indication of uncertainty, which is kind of funny when a lot of the stuff goes back to the vulnerability assessment and a lot of the literature is thin, so professional judgment was used. How exactly do you capture measures of uncertainty, quantifiable measures of uncertainty, when so much of it was based on professional judgment? But what the PDT is going to do going forward is bound the problem with sensitivity runs and provide not just a mean value for example, these Zs at the parser levels, but upper and lower values as well based on the various sensitivity runs. So that is, the sensitivity runs that provide the highest or the lowest values would be incorporated as some sort of a band of uncertainty. The cost efficiency and area closure analyses were appropriate for qualitative discussion. The cost efficiency estimates were not robust to the sensitivity runs, and further development is needed to fully understand the implications. The area closure analysis as constructed relies on assumptions. I'll say that the area closure analysis that was presented to the peer review was not the simple four parcel case. It was a full run 6,200 parcel case with actual data. There were a lot of assumptions that went into that we used that were not sufficiently tested and vetted and need a lot of further development before they can be used. So for the time being, especially, the area closure analysis is just an information tool and not something that we're going to use in impacts analysis or in constructing alternatives. Adverse effects are a function of fishing effort. At the base level, the gear's got to touch the bottom before you can generate an adverse effect. Catching fish quickly and efficiently is going to yield the largest gains in abating adverse effects. The focus going forward should probably be on understanding the relationship between OI and adverse effects. If you are catching more fish, but the rate of adverse effect is not going up as quickly as the rate of catch, that's a good thing. Even though the total number might increase, you are catching fish in a more efficient, habitat-efficient manner, and that's a good thing. And the SASE model enables us to make those calculations. Of the three tools, area closure, gear change, and effort reduction, only the first two appear realistic, and it's important to condition, again, I've said it a couple of times, on making sure that achieving OY is, we don't want people to assume that just because adverse effects might go up over time or in subsequent years, that could be because we're catching a lot closer to OI than we had in the past. Given observed changes in realized adverse effect, the council's objective is most likely going to be to capture high efficiency kind of adverse effects abatement gains where possible. Targeted area closures that focus on areas where you're not going to do more harm than good, where you're not going to displace effort from low vulnerability to high vulnerability areas, and then to investigate if the council or committee or public want to go down the road of potential gear modifications. Prevent abatement loss due to effort displacement. And this could be a pretty big one. And provide suitable platforms for furthering much-needed research. Again, the research that underlies the model and the research on gear effects itself, despite decades of study, is still quite thin, and there's still a lot of work to do. We don't have all of the answers. Shelf-wide seabed and habitat characterization is still very, very spotty, and you can go back to that that data slide that I had that shows this level of certainty. We throughout our domain, we only have sampling that captures all five of our primary substrates on a very small, not very small, on about 30% of the domain or less, 25% of the domain. It would be great if there was more research on, particularly on the recovery side. Just thinking about gear effects in terms of susceptibility and recovery, I think, is a real huge step forward that the committee and the PDT have made over the last 3 years. The effects of energy and energy modeling, the effects of energy on gear effects are understudied and under not sufficiently represented yet. The distribution of biogenic features is definitely unknown. The best data that we have on that is the Thoreau and Wigley data, which goes back to the 60s. So there's much potential for improved research there and find scale habitat feature and fishing effort distributions. There's a lot of work to do on actually getting better spatial distribution of fishing data in. And, of course, the functional relationship between fish stocks and fishery productivity and habitat itself. This is not something that the SASI model is even trying to inform. The data is not there yet, although there's a lot of good stuff coming out of Sandy Hook these days. And I think that's all. I hope that – oh, next steps. Integrate the sensitivity results into the model results, as I said before, is a kind of a quasi-uncertainty, a bound. The PhD is going to be preparing a document that looks at all of the data that we have that lies outside of the SASI model, that is, where the SASI model might not be sufficient for helping the committee to form options. That's a document that the committee should have in their hands before the next committee meeting. Continued development of the cost efficiency and area closure analysis for potential use in impacts analysis. And crafting options. My last comment here is, there's a very large overlap between the first agenda item tomorrow morning and what the committee is going to be able to do with options for minimizing adverse effects. And I do believe that's it. Mr. Chair.
Questions for Chad? Dr. Pierce.
Thanks, Chad. Well done. I'm not going to start at the beginning. I'm going to start at the ending. The review of the SASI model, the conclusions and recommendations provided by the SSC in their final report. Let's see. That would be document 20. 12A. Okay. I'm trying to understand where we're going, the next steps that you've just described. The next steps in the context of the conclusions and recommendations that the SSC has drawn. And by that I mean, how do I reconcile the next steps that you have described with conclusion on page 11 of the review? I'm not being critical, I'm just trying to understand, where the SSC says, although the SASI model itself provides useful information for fishery managers and stakeholders, the practicability analyses presented in the document are not ready for use in their present form, et cetera, et cetera. It is recommended that continued evolution and development of the approach be encouraged, and then it gives us some examples of where there needs to be further work, further development, further exploration. So how do I match the conclusions and recommendations of the SSC with the next steps, which are, with next steps that seem to clash with the SSC recommendations?
Excellent question. So in the comment that you just read, they used the words practicability analysis. One of the problems that that we have and we need to correct and we need to do a better job is nomenclature. All right, we have to define what we're talking about better. And that was one of the major things that the PDT took from the SSC, the peer review. We should be clear that the peer review was not the SSC. Dr. Sullivan was the chair, but everybody else was on the peer review panel was not from the SSC. And so we have a bunch of different things going on. We've got the vulnerability assessment, which feeds into the SASI model. We've got the LISA clusters, which help define manageable spatial areas for looking at potential options. We've got the cost efficiency analysis, which talks about generation of benefits versus costs, and we've got the area closure analysis, and those are all different. We're going to do a better job going forward of referring to those by those names and not couching everything under this kind of SASI model, because those are not SASI model things. The SSC reviews, and so The two things that the practicability analysis, what they were talking about, were the cost efficiency analysis and the area closure analysis. All right? Those comments were not related to the SASE model. And that's a very important, so I'm glad you asked the question, because I think when you read the report, you have to read it carefully to understand which portions they were talking about. And we did not do a good enough job of making these distinctions going in. To be honest, because we've been embroiled in this for so long, a lot of these distinctions got kind of grayed over. And the fact that other people coming in from the outside didn't understand these nuances as well as we did, we lost sight of. And we need to get that back. We need to be able to sharply distinguish between what we're talking about. The cost efficiency analysis, the area closure analysis that were presented to the peer review are not... The peer review does not think, and the PDT would agree, should not be used going forward for constructing alternatives as they were presented to the peer review. The SASE model, the Z Infinity, the Z Realized, the LISA clusters, the vulnerability assessment were all should be used. Not only were they reviewed, but they should be used. And, I mean, I don't know if I can go backwards on this or if I have to go through all 63 slides to get back, but I quoted directly from the peer review report on those things. So, in any case, does that answer your question, Dr. Pierce?
Well, I think you're saying that the practicability analysis is separate from the SASE model?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. That helps clarify it, because you're right, this frequent reference to SASE model problems, but it seems that it's not really a reference to problems. It's a reference to something that's not part of the SASE model.
These are kind of additional uses of the data that the SASE model generates. And we will do a better job of distinguishing these things going forward.
Okay, so the SASE model is ready for prime time based upon the peer review. What is not ready for prime time is the practicability analysis, and you're saying that that's acknowledged by the plan development team, and work is going to be continuing to, I guess,
continue
make it
to
ready
continue.
For prime time.
Correct.
Okay.
Do you have a problem?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad Chad made that distinction. The total body of the work is, in a sense, modular, and the final modules were not completed to the satisfaction of the peer review, nor to the satisfaction of the PDT as well. So that's the area that needs to be continued work on. But that's for future management use. Management use at the current time will be dependent upon the vulnerability assessment, the SASE model itself, and a LISA analysis. And now we've been through sufficient reviews, so it is time to move forward with the amendment, with the amendment number two. We need to include with it the mitigation of negative effects, which is required by law. In the future, we'll be looking toward relating somehow habitat to productivity, but we aren't there yet. That's for SASE 2. It would be nice if we could do that, and in fact, the peer reviewers did identify that as an area for future research and for a future iteration of the entire, I've got to be careful not to do that, I was going to say SASE model, but for the entire set of modules that is centered upon the SASE model. Tomorrow we will be getting a presentation of the white paper that was called for at the last meeting, specifically on the EFH closed areas and their relationship to other management areas, because that's the first real mountain that we have to climb. So I wanted to – that's why I asked John to change the order of how we did things here, because I wanted to get this on the board here before we moved into what is, in fact, the next phase of the amendment. And that really does begin tomorrow. And I said there would be no council action at this meeting. That's on what we have done up till now. We will have to take some action tomorrow based upon how the council reacts to perceives the presentation tomorrow on the EFH closed areas and their relationship to other management areas. So with that in mind, We will also have to be very cognizant of its effect on the future in ecosystem management, which is another ultimate direction we're going. So there are big changes in store, and we have to be sure that we're aware of where they are going. But for the immediate future, we'll be looking at the types of mitigation measures that we're going to take, and we know that the mitigation areas methods that we've used in the past have, as Chad pointed out in his presentation, that many of them have actually had a negative effect, that they have not only not been cost-effective, but they have actually been harmful. And these are the things that we have to address and we have to change. And that's where we need to go tomorrow. So that's, let's see. I had other things I wanted to. No, that's it. Okay, thank you.
Sally?
Yeah, thanks. I have a few questions. I'm not quite sure where to start because, Chad, as you pointed out, you and a handful of others are so familiar with this that it's become second nature, and it's not second nature to other people. So what I'm finding myself looking forward to is seeing some kind of overlay of phase one, the new EFH designations, with what I assume is the LISA model analysis on top of that, so we can see how the two pieces are matching up. And I kind of assume that they will, that there's going to be a critical mass of new EFH designations that will be in the same place as at least some of what the LISA analysis says are important places to protect. Is that a fair assumption, or am I totally off on this?
It's something that can be done. If somebody wants to kind of make the call that these are the species that we care about when it comes to minimizing adverse effects, then you can take the EFH maps and overlay them with the spatial distribution of adverse effect and focus on areas where you can then protect chunks of real estate that are important to a particular species from fishing gears that chunk of real estate might be vulnerable to. But the PET is not in a position to pick those winners, and we haven't been told to. You know, there's 68 species in life stages. There's EFH everywhere, right? So we're looking everywhere. And if it's juvenile, you know, I don't know, Acadian redfish, then we can do those overlays, and that's a very easy thing to do spatially, and it's an easy assessment to provide. But actually figuring out which stocks and life stages people care about, that's a much more difficult thing. So we've been focusing on the interaction between the gear and the substrate, and not the substrate and the fish.
Is there a plan for an AP meeting anytime in the near future? You know, we've heard discussion of the SASE model and the other pieces over the last few months, and certainly a number of advisory panel members have not. I think they need to see the kind of presentation that Chad just did in some form, although I hesitate because that was – well, if you had a whole day to do it, that would make sense. But the other thing is, one of the next steps that was identified is, I don't remember how you phrased it, but other information like Stellwagen or other areas that – other specific and relatively discrete areas that are important. And I think the AP would be – is an important source of information to make sure that you're getting a good comprehensive list.
Dave Prowell?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad Sally brought that up. As in terms of next steps, we won't know exactly what steps we're going to take until after tomorrow when we find out what direction we're going to take. But what I envision right now is as soon as possible a PDT meeting so the PDT can give direction on where we should be going based upon the peer review and what comes out of tomorrow's meeting. And then shortly thereafter, hopefully quite shortly thereafter. I would like to probably at this point, depending again how it evolves, what I envision is a joint committee PDT meeting. And given the amount of stuff that has to be done, it's possible, even likely, that that will wind up being a two-day meeting, perhaps one day with the AP, perhaps both with the AP. But the AP will certainly be involved very soon. And again, depending on how the next 24 hours evolves.
You're suggesting that tomorrow's management area coordination discussion will help inform you as the chair of the Habitat Committee how to proceed?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's a vital part of it.
Yep. Anyone else in the council? Dave Gaethel?
Chad, while I was listening to the presentation, it struck me that one of the analysis we may have to do is to look at what we've already done and say, this may be as much as is practicable. You know, I mean, you showed the reductions already, and it may be that no matter how you move this stuff around, you can't get it any better than it already is. So I think, we do have to keep looking at what we've already done. I mean, you've got a reduction here of 31% in Auditrol Z, and it may be that, you open one place and you close someplace else, but because you do that, you got to tow 100 hours when you only had to use to tow 10. So it may all end up being counterproductive. It may be that after all is said and done with all this exhaustive analysis, we've already done as much as is practicable. And so I wondered if you might want to comment on that a little bit and how you'll kind of have a metric here to see if you are actually, doing more or doing worse.
Right. I think that's the critical way to think about this, not just looking at how we've done over the past, but how we're going to do going forward. And I'm actually really looking forward to getting the 2010 fishing year data in because, for example, trip limits probably radically increased adverse effects relative to just about anything else, right? Because you're forcing people to drag extra time to achieve the same outcome. And so I'm really interested in seeing how this past year's management will have affected kind of the catch versus adverse effect equation. And I think we'll be able to quantify that. So the objective should be, I think, to continue to improve that relationship going forward. Now, you can do that. You might be able to do that if you can identify, for example, chunks of real estate that are highly vulnerable and not very profitable and close those off. Those are the right areas. There are some other extra sassy information like Sally was talking about that the PDT is going to be gathering and presenting to the committee, areas that regardless of the profitability should probably, and I'm thinking of like the kelp forest on the top of Cash's Ledge, things like that that are unique and definitely should be protected. But even those aside, if you can kind of take a more focused approach towards durable area closures, you can probably positively affect that ratio, that relationship between adverse effect and how close to OI you're getting or your net revenues or whatever proxy for successful fisheries you want to have. And we should be tracking that relationship, not necessarily the total adverse effect. For example, the scallop fishery, the total adverse effect from the scallop fishery has remained relatively constant from 96 to now. It's down 15%, like I said, from 2003 to now. But clearly the profitability of that fishery has gone up radically, right? The benefits versus cost relationship has changed radically over the last 8 years. That's the kind of change that we want to see from the gear type that has the most adverse effect in numbers terms from the otter trawl fishery. If we can continue to fish more efficiently, that will be what gets us closer to minimizing adverse effects more than anything. And in terms of, we've done all this work and maybe we don't change anything, that might not be a bad outcome. There might be room to improve, but we've done all this work and at least now we can speak about these things on common terms, quantify them within the bounds of all of the assumptions that went into the analysis, and we can track the trends over time. So even if at the end of the day nothing changes, I don't think all this work has been wasted, first of all. I think we've learned a tremendous amount. And I think we'll be able to monitor the habitat efficiency performance of our fisheries in a much better way going forward.
Yeah, I didn't want to certainly imply that the work's been wasted. I don't think it's been wasted at all. I think, if anything, it can be used to inform decisions on what's already been done. And I just want to make sure, and you've already said it, that we measure against something. We have to have some means of comparing various schemes, if you will. You know, we're going to close this, open that. We're going to restrict ground gear. Whatever it is we're going to do, we have to have some way of looking at that and saying, yeah, we can actually show you that this is a net economic benefit to the nation, that it isn't just 18 people sitting around here throwing dots at a board over there, and this is the thing that came out of the, got hit. Because I think if we can't do that, then we're going to have issues down the road with selling it to the public.
I had Sally and then Dave Preble.
Two questions. What is the updated timeline for completion of the amendment, and what are the staffing resources available to get it done in the foreseeable future?
Dave Preble.
I like those questions if we can get an answer to them. In response to what Dave Gaethel said, we've in general found here that in terms of the bang you get for the buck, increasing efficiency is way better than anything else. Particularly, it's better, much better than closures. And that's been generally what the SASE and LISA have demonstrated. So I just wanted to reinforce what Chad said, is that in that when we increase the efficiency, that's probably the best thing we can do for protecting the habitat. There's probably very little reason to engage in a closure other than for spawning and habitat. It's really hard to imagine much else, that's important for closure.
Dave, I was actually looking to you as the committee chair to answer Sally's questions. So what's the current timeline have for a completion date and your staffing?
As far as the time for completion, again, that's going to I'll be in a much better position to estimate that after tomorrow's discussion, because it's going to depend on which direction the council wants to take with this. As far as staffing is concerned, we need another full-time staff member on this. I'd like to see the Northeast Fisheries Science Center donate David Stevenson for a year.
Okay, Dr. Jim, are you going to answer that request? That's a yes. Welcome aboard, David.
No, I had a question or a comment. So go ahead. I just wanted to comment on the overall decline in the adverse effects over time, which is good. But I noticed that the hydraulic clam dredge, which is has the highest impact, that actually has increased by almost 50% over time. I believe somewhere about midway through your slides, there was one that showed that. And the model seems really useful for seeing whether these hydraulic clam dredges are being towed over longer distances over the bottom or moving to more vulnerable habitats. And I'd like to note that in the last year or two, there have been some fisheries now on George's Bank for the first time on surf clam. So it's just seems like a really valuable example that you can explore with this model that's in the could have high sensitivity to changes.
We've looked at that in the case of the clam dredge fishery, and it initially, anyway, appears to be a CPUE effect and not a moving from less vulnerable to a more vulnerable bottom. They're simply towing more.
Paul Howard?
Just a couple things about resources and staffing. I was under the impression that Dave Stevenson was a very productive member of the PDT, so I don't know where you've gone with that. And the other thing is, just keep in mind that we have a reduction in resources and funding this year, and next year is going to be worse. So just keep that in mind.
David Pierce.
Okay, Chad, again, I have faith seeking understanding to understand this model so I can feel really comfortable with it. So just one question. You began by describing the models and analyses. Number one was the vulnerability assessment, then the SASE model, then the LISA analysis, then cost efficiency analysis, and then area closure analysis. The vulnerability assessment, the first in the list, that's an important component of the SASE model?
It does two things.
But
it answers the fundamental question, which gears and which habitats. That's kind of the question. We're talking about essential fish habitat adverse effects minimization. Which gears, which habitats? So from the vulnerability assessment, if you look at nothing else in our analysis, you would conclude mobile bottom tending gears, hydraulic clam dredge, otter trawl, scallop dredge. Much more likely to generate adverse effects than fixed gears. Right? Which gears, which habitats? We define habitats based on dominant substrate. Dominant substrates that consist of harder, larger substrates, larger particles.
Excuse me, I get that. It's an important part of the SASE model, correct?
It then, with those SNR values,
it's
feeds into.
It's an input.
Yes.
Okay. That in that case, the vulnerability assessment requires some estimates of susceptibility and recovery, the so-called S and the R.
Right.
Right. Okay. I get that. But now I've got to reconcile that understanding with your next-to-last slide where you say there is much we don't know. And the second bullet is gear effects with particular attention to susceptibility and recovery. So how do I reconcile that much we don't know with the important part of this equation being we need to know susceptibility and recovery in order to do the vulnerability analysis that's part of the SASE model. So how do I reconcile that?
It's important that the policymakers, that the council and the committee, and that the public also understand the limits of the literature. We constrained ourselves to the literature, and in fact, the PDT went through a very interesting evolutionary process where individual members probably changed their opinion on gear effects 180 degrees after reading 400 and some odd studies and coding them in a database, you know, based on all of these different metrics, et cetera, et cetera. You reconcile it. First, you can look numerically at the matrices that the PDT generated and say, we have lots of literature that supports these conclusions. We have very thin literature that supports these conclusions. But you can go back and look at that. So those SNR values, with the data that underlie those, varies wildly. For fixed gears, there's not much. It's a lot of professional judgment. For otter trawls, it's a lot more. That's the strongest case that we can make. You can then, if you wanted to do it qualitatively rather than just numerically, you can go back and read the individual studies and see if you can agree with the PDT. And certainly, we do that more for the public's benefit than the council. We're doing the work on your behalf, obviously, so we're hoping that you will trust our opinion. But it's also second-guessable by all of the interested parties. So the conclusions that we draw that feed into the SASE model should be very traceable. And anybody should be able to either agree or disagree with us by going back and looking at the studies that underlie it and saying either we misinterpreted this or you use professional judgment here and we would just want to disagree. And I'm sure that stuff will come out through the public process, especially when the rubber meets the road and we start actually talking about alternatives.
Okay, so good. So eventually we will get the best professional judgment of the plan development team regarding the S and the R.
You've already got it. That's it.
Well, we already got it. Okay, fine enough. So it's going to be up to us then to look at it and say we disagree or agree. And if we disagree, we have to give good reasons as to why we disagree, because now we're up against, you know, some professional judgment of some of staff that has done some great work on this. Okay. All right. I get it. Thank you.
Well, I will point out that we're acting on your behalf. We're not actually asking you to read them all. But if you'd like to, you certainly may.
Good. David?
Yeah, I guess this is one last comment. I just, once again, I'd like to express my complete admiration with the PDT for the work that they did on this over the space of the last 4 years. It's a remarkable product to have been put out by this group of people, specifically working under the aegis of the New England Fishery Management Council. I didn't realize Dave Stevenson was sitting there when I made that remark. I agree with Paul. I agree with Paul. He's been an enormously effective member of the PDT, which is why I'd like to have him assigned full time to help us finish the amendment.
Okay. Thanks, Chad. We'll take a 15-minute break. When we come back, Dr. Fogarty et al. For the rest of the